What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in. I am your host, Josh Cohen. This episode, I have the pleasure and honor of speaking with Tom Wilson, who was a former NYPD sergeant on 9/11. After his exposure to toxic debris from the collapsed Twin Towers, Tom Wilson recalled his eyes and throat burning. However, the exposure ultimately took a significant toll. Severe sinusitis, gastrointestinal issues, and an aggressive cancerous tumor on the tongue, among many other adverse health effects. Wilson secured the Manhattan side of the Williamsburg Bridge on 9/11, conducted security around Ground Zero in the month following, was involved in rescue efforts, and among other assignments, searched rooftops in Lower Manhattan for remains. He also combed through the Fresh Kills landfill on Staten Island for hours at a time, well into April 2002, sifting and raking through debris for items like bone fragments, rings, and personal belongings to bring victims' families closure. It was an honor to speak with him and hear his story. I hope you find it engaging and informative. And without further ado, I will bring you Tom Wilson. Okay, I'm here with Tom Wilson. Tom, thanks for coming on the podcast.
You're welcome.
Very happy to have you. Before we jump into what your brush with history was like, Tom, please tell listeners kind of who you are and what you do.
My name is Thomas Wilson. I'm 53 years old. I live in Bellport, New York. It's on Long Island, about 60 miles east of Manhattan, on the south shore of Long Island. You have the Great South Bay and then the Atlantic Ocean. So that's where I reside. I have my wife and five children, ages 13 to 21. I'm a retired police officer with the Suffolk County Police Department. That's Long Island has two counties, Suffolk County and Nassau County. They each have about 1.5 million people. On 9/11, though, I was employed by the New York City Police Department. I was a sergeant with the NYPD. I left NYPD in November 2002, came out to Suffolk, and I retired after 26 years.
Wow. Yeah. Excellent. Thank you, Tom. I appreciate that. Yes. So then winding the clock back then, of course, to that infamous date, September 11th, 2001, could you please describe what the experience was like of when you first got the call about the World Trade Center?
Yeah, I was actually working that day. At that time, September 11th, 2001, I was a sergeant in the 9-0 precinct. 9-0 precinct covers Williamsburg and Bushwick, Brooklyn. And I was the supervisor of the BAT team, the burglary apprehension team. And normally my responsibility as a BAT sergeant, burglary sergeant, I had my own crew. It was myself and five other police officers. And we follow up on burglaries. We try to, at that time, arrest predicate felons, burglaries, or stop the burglary conditioning within the precinct. Usually there was a nexus with narcotics. And we make a lot of narcotics arrests to stem the burglary problem. Anyway, I was the burglary sergeant that day. When you're in a detail like that, a burglary team, anti-crime team, a street narcotics team, you always have, in police work, you always have to have police officers handle 911 calls, always. That's a bare minimum. But when you're in those specialized units, if something comes up, you'll be reassigned to those other details. So 9/11 happened to be primary election day that day in New York City. So the five guys under my command were actually assigned to separate details with the election detail. Police officers would just monitor the polling sites, make sure everything's peaceful. That's been going on since probably the beginning of elections, I know, at least since I came on the job. So I was actually alone that day, because my crew was assigned to different election posts. So I was actually following up on a burglary that occurred the night before, when the radio on my hip kind of blew up with the World Trade Center being struck. And I remember I was interviewing an older couple, the victims of the burglary, and I said, I got to leave. And so I left them. And the 9-0 precinct covers the Williamsburg Bridge, the Willie B. Bridge, which connects Brooklyn to Manhattan. There's three bridges on the Lower East Side that cover connect Lower Manhattan. We call them BMW. You have the Brooklyn Bridge, Manhattan Bridge, and the Williamsburg Bridge. So I decided to, as a sergeant supervisor, to shut down the Williamsburg Bridge. At that time, just one trade center was struck. Wasn't aware that was a terrorist attack, but I knew, could see the large amount of smoke, knew it was pretty severe, and that emergency apparatus would have to get from other boroughs across the bridge into Lower Manhattan. So I shut down the bridge to originally facilitate emergency vehicles to get into Lower Manhattan. So I shut down the Williamsburg Bridge on the Manhattan side over at Delancey and Clinton. And my the anti-crime sergeant, Richie Payden, again, anti-crime is another separate detail, and he shut down the Brooklyn side. And that's where I was in the, I spent about 16, 17 hours on that bridge that day, but originally, again, facilitating vehicles going across. Now the second tower hits and realize, all right, this is an attack on our nation. And I was already on the bridge, and my mindset immediately went to, all right, it's an act of war, and these fuckers are going to blow up the bridges and tunnels. You know, it's going to continue. And my mindset went back. I was in the Army, United States Army. I was in the military police, 423rd MP Company. And at one point during my Army career, I was deployed to Bosnia and Herzegovina. And one of the assignments I had over there was the Sava River Bridge was blown up at one point during the Balkan War, and then it was rebuilt. So now when the American troops and the other nations, NATO nations, were over there providing security, one of the primary missions my platoon was assigned was to secure that bridge, the Sava River Bridge, which connected Croatia to the Republic Srpska, Serbia. If it was rebuilt, and we had to make sure it wasn't blown up again. And that was my mindset. Now I'm on the Williamsburg Bridge, and I asked for more personnel to help secure that bridge. And so that's where that was like the second mission that day. First, facilitate emergency vehicles going in. Now that our nation was under attack, to secure that bridge, critical infrastructure.
Yes.
And then the third mission that day, which haunts me to this day, is there was no way when the towers came down, everything was shut down. All subways, motor vehicle traffic. There were only two ways off of Manhattan Island. One was by boat, and I'm not too familiar with that. I've met a boat captain with the Feel Good Foundation, and there was a massive rescue, bigger than Dunkirk, actually, from a historical perspective, of boats. For example, Mike McPhillips with the Feel Good Foundation, he was a captain with New York Waterway. Anyway, ferries, all types, private boats. They picked up people from Lower Manhattan, brought them to Jersey, or looped back around to bring them into Queens. But that was the one way off. And the one I was actually involved in was the only other way off was by foot. And those three bridges that day, Brooklyn, Manhattan, Williamsburg, my experience in the Williamsburg, just it was a mass exodus, thousands upon thousands of people on foot fleeing Manhattan. And that was the other mission that day, was just to safely bring people across. And, you know, people were coming, people were wounded, covered in dust. A lot of people didn't have shoes, and probably stayed on that bridge till about 11, 12 that night. And that was my first day. That was my experience on 9/11, spending it primarily at Delancey and Clinton, the on-ramp to the Williamsburg Bridge on the Manhattan side. My first day at Ground Zero.
Yes, sir.
It was on the 12th at about, couldn't really sleep, stayed in Brooklyn that night. And couldn't sleep, got up early. And as I mentioned earlier, the anti-crime sergeant, Richie Payton, again, as a burglary sergeant, anti-crime sergeant, we're kind of like spare bodies. Again, you always have to have somebody on patrol to answer 911 calls. So we decided to respond to the Brooklyn North THV. Prior to that, actually, Williamsburg, Brooklyn is a very diverse, especially back then. Now it's been, a lot of it's been regentrified and trendy and whatnot. But back then, there was a lot of different neighborhoods. And one of the neighborhoods has a large Hasidic Jewish community. And Richie knew one of the, an owner in the Hasidic community of a hardware store. We woke that owner up, kind of old school. He lived right above his, the hardware store. Woke him up and said, we're going to be going down to the World Trade Center site, like to get some type of equipment. And we didn't know about carcinogens then or anything like that. So we didn't have masks. We were looking more for work gear. And we were able to obtain heavy duty work gloves. And once we obtained those work gloves, we went down to ground zero. And it was just a scene of total devastation. And thought, and this is something I can want to speak to this day too. We thought we were just going to be rescuing people left and right. There was nobody to rescue. It was, everything was pulverized except for big chunks of concrete or rebar steel. And ironically, a lot of paper blowing around. And at one point, I remember when we were on the bucket brigade removing debris, I said to Richie, Richie, you see that pulsating light? I saw a pulsating light through the smoke. And I thought it was somebody signaling, because it's all surreal. The whole, I remember the Trade Center throughout my life. You see it all the time when you live there, work there. And now it's hard to wrap your whole mind about it. But I thought somebody was signaling us from one of the facades. I saw the pulsating light, kind of like if somebody was on a stranded island, it would shine a light for a ship. I said, holy shit, Richie, I see that He says, yeah, let's try to get to that light. So we walked around the whole site, got as close as we can to that pulsating light. It turned out to be just dangling glass in the haze. And when it would shift, it would send off, a beam of light. But there was no one to rescue. So, that was my first day, actually, at Ground Zero.
That's extraordinary, Tom. Thank you. I should probably ask, just for an audience clarification, who is Richie?
Richie Payton? He's anti-crime sergeant at the 9-0 precinct.
Understood. Let me see, just to move forward then, I'd love to ask you, I know we spoke about a little bit about this previously, what is, or perhaps what was, the Fresh Kills landfill?
Okay, Fresh Kills landfill.
Yes, sir.
Like, again, as a burglary sergeant, I had different assignments, and I would always have, they call it a span and control. A sergeant usually has a span and control of one sergeant and 6 to 8 police officers under the command. And on the 13th and 14th, one assignment was to check rooftops or surrounding buildings or immediately around where the Trade Center used to be. So we searched those rooftops for any remains of redeeming value. Another assignment I just stumbled upon on the 14th, Brooks Brothers department store, the clothing store, was directly across from Ground Zero at One Liberty Plaza. The whole front facade was blown out. And in those early days at Ground Zero, people would start yelling, or you would hear an air horn blow to leave the site, because there was fear that additional buildings were going to collapse or another attack was happening. So, everyone just would scatter from the site and waiting for the all clear. So as I left the site, I went into One Liberty Plaza, and I saw 6 or 7 individuals. And even back then, to me, that site was very sacred. I see him actually stealing clothing from the Brooks Brothers. And even though I happen to be a burglary sergeant, I said, what are you guys doing? And a bunch of them took off. I was able to grab one. And he had an enormous amount of clothing, belts on him, clothing underneath. And I brought him to the first precinct and processed him for burglary, looting. Now, that's just as a side note. Mm-hmm. Now, Fresh Kills landfill is all the debris from the lower Manhattan Ground Zero site got removed to Fresh Kills landfill. And Fresh Kills landfill is located on Staten Island. It was at one time a landfill that at that time was recently closed down. I think a small segment of it might have still been open. And all the debris, the original recovery in lower Manhattan, it was originally the bucket brigade, and the big heavy machinery would come in. And those guys were great, all the construction workers. But all the debris would be placed at the lower Manhattan site into either trucks or barges and brought over to Staten Island Fresh Fields landfill. And at Staten Island landfill, a more thorough, it was kind of like a giant crime scene, a more thorough search or a sift would be done at the Freshfields landfill. And I was detailed there for certain tours. And you had two assignments. And I partook in two of those assignments. I'm talking as a police officer now. You know, the FBI was there too. And, you know, you had the heavy equipment operators would dump the debris. But as a actual for evidence recovery or to recover remains that we could bring closure to family, the first assignment I had, I was given a metal rake and a piece of heavy machinery would drop the debris in a grid square. And I would go with that rake. And you also handed a spackle bucket, you know, an empty plastic bucket to put any remains you might find into that bucket. And you rake through that debris. And if you found something, you put it in the bucket. And there was a evidence trailer that you would bring it to the evidence trailer and it would get logged in. And so it was one of the assignments I had there. And the other assignment is, and actually when I cleaned out my locker recently, when I retired, I found an old detail roster. And because now I was looking at the names on that roster and I was like, oh, I wonder how those guys are making out. Because when you're at it, when you're detailed, I wasn't detailed with I was from the 9-0 precinct, but a large department like the NYPD, you could, at that detail, the six personnel assigned to me came from other commands. Like on that detail roster, it was people from the 120 precinct, which covers a portion of Staten Island, 7-9, which is Brooklyn, and then what was the other command? Manhattan South Narcotics District. So there were a lot of detectives on that detail. And anyway, I found that. And that assignment I had in that detail roster, just to give you the scope of how long the recovery process was on dated April 24th, 2002. Shows you how long the recovery process was. And that assignment, I was a sifter. And what that was, a conveyor belt would dump much finer debris, smaller debris, onto a conveyor belt. And there were four police officers, detectives on each side of the conveyor belt as the conveyor belt moves with the debris on it. And if you found something, you would pick that debris up and again put it in the plastic bucket and bring it to the evidence trail. And the thing about that with the conveyor belt, once the debris went off the conveyor belt, that was it. And, you know, for the search purposes. So you know, you kind of feel, you look back on it, you know, there's still 17, I believe, I want to say about 1,100 people have still not been identified or recovered. And, you know, you look back and you think, you know, what did I miss on those conveyor right. belts? And so that's where the Fresh Hills landfill. And I think they shut the landfill down. I want to say, was it July or August of 2002? So the recovery went a very long time. And that's that. That's what Fresh Hills landfill was.
Understood. Thank you, sir. It's very important to me that we also discuss the aftermath here. I want to sort of pull that in here. And perhaps we'll just kind of start simply. Tom, can you please talk about your personal experiences following 9/11?
Immediately after 9/11, in some capacity, again, as a burglary sergeant, I was continuously at work. I know at that time, my son was born in October of 2000. So we were going to have his first birthday in October of 2001. And I remember we didn't have that birthday party. I either slept at the precinct or at times I slept in a bank lobby at Ground Zero or an office building. I wasn't home for like the first month. Not that I always worked at Ground Zero. A lot of times I'd be assigned to, again, it was great concern at that time. Again, I just thinking back now on 9/11, I remember securing that Williamsburg Bridge. And I would love to know historically during incidents like this, I'm sure the unknown and the rumors of what's going on. And one of the big ones was, I remembered vividly of armored cars with assault teams inside the armored cars were going to attack critical structures. And I was like, how are we going to stop that? But, you know, you man your post. But anyway, I was part of what they call mega posts. You know, you secure critical infrastructure. So I wasn't home for about a month. You know, you're working these 12-hour tours. And, you know, they turn into 13 hours. And by the time you get back to the precinct, so wasn't home for that first month or two. And then I don't want to say things got back to normal. It's just, you know, everything changed after that. I don't know if that answered your question.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Well, I guess I was hoping to pull in the Zadroga Act and John Feel Good Foundation, et cetera. Yes, sir. Sorry.
Yeah, now the medical stuff, and you didn't think about it back then. I never really wore, I know at Fresh Kills Landfill, I had a Tyvek suit and a respirator. Ironically, your tours were 12 hours long, and the respirators and the mask only work for 8 hours. You know, they're only supposed to be good for 8 hours. And the chow hall, the dining facility, was actually on at the landfill. It was very windy up there. You didn't really think about it back then. I know at some point, because I got I do appreciate with the NYPD, I think it was on September 17th, they put out an operations order for 9/11 exposure numbers for NYPD personnel. And I ended up getting a 9/11 exposure number. Originally, I think it was the first year or two after, individuals with those exposure numbers went to like a preliminary physical, like a respiratory. And I don't remember how I did on that physical, but I know maybe 2 to 3 years after, because I was always healthy. And you got to remember that, especially with the first responders. You have to pass a strenuous physical to get in, both physically and mentally. They check your mental health and your physical health. And then the actual academy itself, there's a lot of physical training along with all the academics and everything else. It's a very hard physical training because they want to make sure your body is capable and that you don't have any pre-existing conditions. So I was through the United States Army basic training in the MP school and then the NYPD Academy. And I was always physically active. And then the Suffolk County Academy in 02. And it was probably about 03, 04. So I had to get the a lot of respiratory and sinus problems. And I'm like, what the hell's going on? Always healthy, working out. And then that's the early days I got involved with it. You know, somebody referred me to the World Trade Center Health Program in those early days. And eventually I got certified for numerous conditions, sinus conditions, throat conditions, chest bronchitis conditions. And in those early years, they were pretty tough, but they... But what really kicked my ass was in late 2008. I had a huge mass on my tongue, and it turned out to be a very aggressive form of tongue cancer. And like many 9/11 responders, like I was just talking to a buddy who had prostate cancer. You would think, oh, prostate cancer, he would get some radiation seeds and be okay. But it turns out to be very aggressive. He had a major surgery. Same with mine. A lot of these, because of the carcinogens, the cancers are very aggressive. And my cancer had what's called paranormal invasion, meaning the tumor invaded into the muscle and bone depth. And I had to have a large portion of my tongue removed. And then, I don't know if you see the scar here, I had my neck dissected. And then dissected a second time for the lymph nodes. And then I had an artery taken out of my left arm and implanted into my neck from here. The collarbone, there's a clamp to my new tongue. And then I had a large portion of my wrist removed. And that's my new tongue. That's how I'm able to talk to you. And then what happened was I followed up with, because the cancer was so aggressive, I had to get 6 weeks of radiation, head and neck radiation. And I understand the radiation's necessary, but head and neck radiation, I'm sure all radiation, but head and neck radiation You lay down. They put a mask over you so you don't move, like a mesh mask with holes. And then I had a straw put in my mouth so I could breathe as the radiation machine goes. No, I know it's necessary, but it's like medieval. And even thinking back now, and that's what I suffer from a lot now is the effects of the surgery and head and neck radiation. Now I deal with radiation fibrosis in the neck, cervical dystonia, and osteoradionecrosis of the jaw. I had to follow up surgeries to fix my jaw, remove teeth. And I'm sure if there's head and neck cancer patients, they understand this because especially with the radiation, as my oncologist, Dr. Caressi says, radiation is the gift that keeps on giving, unfortunately. And, with the long-term side effects, but that's that.
Understood. Thank you for sharing that, Tom. So then how was it you came to be involved with John Feel and the Feel Good Foundation?
Yeah, what happened was actually with the World Trade Center Health Program, when I had my cancer, they weren't certified yet because the numbers weren't there yet. And but the doctor, Dr. Ram at the World Trade Center Health Program, said, listen, I know cancers aren't covered yet, but I got this mask and feel great. He sent me into Mount Sinai Hospital where Dr. Eric Gendon saved my life. Incredible man. And but Dr. Ram from the World Trade Center Health Program, he had the foresight to refer me to Dr. Gendon in Manhattan. And when I saw Dr. Gendon a week later, I had that surgery. So I always had that lasting love for the World Trade Center Health Program for doing that referral and kind of basically saving my life. And the way I got involved with the Feel Good Foundation, when I was very sick, I was using up a lot of sick time. And I didn't think it was right. And at this point, then later on, a couple of years later, my cancer was certified. My other conditions were certified. I believe I have like 8 medical certified conditions and then also PTSD. While I'm going through my treatments and recovery, I'm burning through all my sick time. And I was like, I talked to another gentleman, Craig Capolino, who was like me, who worked for the NYPD, and he was a detective. He came out to Suffolk County like me. He ended up getting blood cancer. I was like, it didn't sit right for me that we had to burn through this sick time, all this sick time, and for something that was starting to be proven as 9/11 related. And for example, I went back, I lost, when I was sick with the cancer, I lost over 100 pounds. I finished my radiation in December 08. I ended up going back to work January 1st, 09, back full duty. And 2 months later, I'm on a traffic detail and a motor vehicle crash with SPI, serious physical injury. Actually, it was a school bus. And I had an area of roadway that I closed, shut down, flared out, with flares and I had flashing lights in my car. And anyway, I was struck by a motorist that drove through my road closure. It went through the windshield, flipped down onto the ground, nearly died in that regard. Fortunately, I had a massive hematoma that was on my hip and ass. If it was my head, I wouldn't be talking, But I was airlifted to Stony Brook Hospital. But I probably shouldn't have been working, but I rushed myself back running through that time. And from 2009, after I got out of the hospital after getting run over, it was like, this kind of one. So I talked to my old union. I tried to get the unions involved. They said, Tommy, you're kind of in a gray area. You work for another job on 9/11, with the NYPD, but yet now you're at Suffolk County. There's really no employer-employee relationship. And, you're kind of out of luck. So it's like, who can I reach out to? And then I found out about just doing research, the Feel Good Foundation. And I called him up and I spoke to, emailed John Feel. And then he referred me to Anthony Flamia, who was the law enforcement liaison. And they said, listen, we understand what you're saying and we're going to help you. But right now, and this was in 2009, we're going to try to deal with this James Aroga bill. You want to help out with that? They said, listen, we're going to help you out down the line, but would you be interested? And I said, sure. And that's how I got involved with that. And first time I got involved was Senator Scott Brown in Massachusetts. And this is in the early days for the original Aroga bill. We're trying to get him on board. So back then, the Feel Good Foundation, I jumped on a bus with the Feel Good Foundation. And we drove up to Boston to try to get Senator Scott Brown on board. And that's how I got involved in the periphery back then. I continued to work, went back to work full duty. So I wasn't, after that trip with Scott Brown, I didn't make all the trips down to D.C. when it first passed in 2010, 2011. But in 2014, 2015, that's when I got heavily involved. The Feel Good Foundation started, it became, I don't want to say more professional, it became more organized. And you kind of evolve and learn through the process. And that's when I started to go down to D.C. numerous times. And that's when I became heavily involved. And my team leader was a firefighter named John Field. He was very organized. You know, he set up teams and we had booklets. We would go in with information and or data. And my team leader, Rob Serra, who was a firefighter, FDMY, we would go in. We would sit down and talk with, usually it was, you never really talk with the principal, the actual a congressperson or senator. In certain cases, it did. But we would go in there, and it worked. And I do remember back then, we had a meeting with, and I remember John was there and Richie Palmer. And, you know, I was just a foot soldier. I would usually just keep my mouth shut, except when I was with Rob Serra. Then we would go, you know, we were in Mitch McConnell's office and chief of staff. I remember big oval table. And there's probably about 15 of us in there. And chief of staff goes, well, there's really no precedent for this. And I look over and there happened to be a big bust of a coal miner, you know, with a light helmet and with the helmet with the light on it.
Yeah.
And, beautiful bust made out of coal, you know, nice, very a good size from like the chest up. And I put my arm around and I was right near that coal miner, that piece. And I put my arm around him and I said, all due respect, sir. You know, I finally spoke up and I said, actually, there is a precedent, you know, the Black Loan Bill. And that's why that coal miner was there, you know, Kentucky, which Mitch McConnell represents, big coal mining state. And then I think a day or two later, John and the big leaders in the Feel Good Foundation had a meeting with Mitch McConnell and got him on board for that. So that was very rewarding. Yeah, that's how I originally got involved. And then the evolution, we would go with data. You know, I remember when we were first educating the Congress people, we had to educate them because a lot of them, you get a congressperson from outside the New York metro area, they think it's a parochial issue. And there's 435 congressional districts, but at 434 of those 435 congressional districts as a sick 9/11 responder, whether they moved there from the New York metro area, like say Florida, North Carolina, but you would also have your USAR teams, your urban search and rescue teams, and they all responded to Ground Zero. And, and then they went back to their states. So out of those 435 districts, 434 had a sick first responder. And wow. We had all that data correlated. And again, the evolution. And then eventually, Rob and I, we would actually print out the Congress people's Facebook posts or social media posts. Because every 9/11, just like Veterans Day for veterans, what do you see on a...
Never forget.
Officials, you say, never forget. Every 9/11, never forget, remember, yeah. Whatever. So we'd print those out because we wanted co-sponsorship. Because co-sponsorships, instead of saying, yeah, I just support a bill, when you're a co-sponsor, you support it a lot more. So we would always end a meeting where I would read the, this is with Rob and I, our team, in the individual meetings. We just want to end this meeting. This is what your boss, especially when it was a staff member, this is what your boss said this past 9/11, and I said, I'm going to read this to you with my reconstructed tongue that now at this point, because there were so many cancers that the Centers for Disease Control and NIOSH certified my cancer as 9/11. And I would read that to the staff members. And then also, I'm sure you saw John Stewart's testimony.
I sure did.
And it's very impressive. And yeah. One of the things that sticks out to me Actually, I didn't make that. That's the one trip I did not make because I was getting jaw surgery. Is when he talks about the most precious commodity of having the responders go down there.
Time.
He said time. And I would always say to Rob, my team leader, I said, listen, and he had young children, and I had young children at that time. I said, we're making this round trip, hundreds of miles. We're not here to jerk around. We're going to get things done. So we'd actually confront very respectfully congresspeople in the hallway because they have to go back and forth for votes and meetings from committee meetings. And, you know, I'll give you one quick example. And it was, I think, it was the final push for the VCF. So it had to be like 2018. Actually, let me digress for a minute, because sure. In 2010 and 2015, the Zeroga bill never passed as what's called a standalone bill. And we always want a standalone bill. It always passed in some type of omnibus package.
Right.
And just to educate your viewers on what that means is the omnibus bill is like a massive spending bill, transportation bills, where a lot of little bills will be included in those bills, and they just get voted on up or down. And we were always, we were never really truly happy. We always thought the bills, our bills should be voted as a standalone bill. And it never was until 2019. And I remember speaking with, I know you're from Minnesota.
Yes.
Yeah. I remember Congresswoman Omar made some type of comment. And Congressman Dan Crenshaw from Texas rebutted that comment. And we never got involved in the individual politics we were dialed into. We were focused on passing this bill. But I was thinking to myself, you know what? And to me, Dan Crenshaw is a hero, a war hero. But I was like, you know what? Is he a co-sponsor on a bill? And I looked. And I said, he's not. And then I looked and I looked. Is Congresswoman Omar a co-sponsor on our bill? And she is. So Rob and I kind of confronted Congressman Crenshaw on that in the hallway. And he was with another congressperson. You know, we introduced ourselves and always had my sergeant's lapel on me. And Rob was would always have a FDNY patches. And, you know, we say, you know, great to meet you, sir. And, you know, why aren't you a co-sponsor on this bill? And he says, oh, I got to look into it. You know, you always never get like a definitive answer. And then I remember talking to a Daily News reporter and said, you know, people are criticizing Congresswoman Omar. But I'll tell you what, she's a co-sponsor on this bill. And a lot of people aren't that post things on 9/11. And I know John Feel ended up getting a personal meeting with Congressman Crenshaw a couple of days later, and he became a co-sponsor. As another side note, you know, because we would call people out on their hypocrisy, but also at all the meetings I partook in, because you always would be like, oh, we'll get back to you. We got to look into this. One congressperson during the meeting actually said, and his name is Stephen Knight from Los Angeles. He says, I'm going to sign up. I'm on a co-sponsor right now. And that made all those trips worth it because unfortunately he was not voted in the last rounds, but he was the only one that I dealt with that actually said, I'm co-sponsoring this bill right now. And that was great to see. And then I had the opportunity to be invited to the Rose Garden when President Trump's the final bill and James Zeroga, Louis Alvarez, Ray Pfeiffer, Reauthorization Act. Mm-hmm. And that was the only time in all the bills that it was a standalone bill. And that was that. And then to get back to my original involvement, John Thiel and I, after the bill was passed in what, 2015, 2016, we went right up to Albany. And that sick leave bill I was talking about earlier, we had a Senator Todd Kominsky, a state senator, and Marty Golden. They came together and we ended up passing that sick leave bill. So now 9/11 responders who worked in one jurisdiction during 9/11 and then came to another jurisdiction and get sick with a certified illness. Again, these are certified illnesses. They go through a vetting process, but now covered for their sick leave. So, and we passed that in Albany in 2017. So that's that.
That's that. I love it. Let me see. Thank you, Tom, so much. I think that might be it, Tom. So, Tom Wilson, this was a real pleasure. This was an honor. I'll tell you the same thing I told Mike O'Connell when I interviewed him last week. I think I'm in awe of you guys. I think you guys are heroes. And it was an honor to be able to chat with you for a little while.
Yeah, it was definitely not the heroes that day. You know, I got additional 21 years now with my wife and 5 children. So that day, I got through that day. You know, again, I was on Delancey and Clinton. You know, if the trade centers would have fell down like in a long form, maybe I wouldn't be talking to you. But, you know, the true heroes perished that day. And then all who've perished since. And I worked with both of them. Ray Pfeiffer, I remember carrying his wheelchair because we would go into the Hart or Russell building or Longworth, Rayburn and Cannon. I still remember all those building names. And those are the legislative office buildings in Washington, D.C. And, you know, there's a lot of steps and a lot of places don't have ramps. So you would have to carry Ray up in his wheelchair. And I drove him home one day from D.C. to his house in East Meadow, Long Island. Phenomenal man. And then, of course, walking the halls with Lou Alvarez. And so there's a lot of people that are, you know, I mentioned Mike McPhillips earlier, who worked for New York Waterway as a ship captain. You know, he's going through some tough problems right now with his cancer. But anyway, I appreciate you taking the time. And I wonder,
my pleasure,
what we do now with the Feel Good Foundation.
Yes.
This legislation passes. We'll go speak to schools or colleges, and they usually contact John Feel. You just go to the Feel Good Foundation. And, you know, a couple months ago, I spoke at Lynbrook High School. We always go to the University of Scranton and give like almost a historical lesson, not just of what we did down in Lower Manhattan or Fresh Schools Landfill, but we also incorporate what we did at, down at Washington, D.C. or Albany, and you know, how just a bunch of regular people were able to push through some life-saving legislation. And to me, that's sacred ground down there. You know, we had the opportunity, I don't know if anyone ever told you, we would always get invited to see the actual vote when the vote would be, you know, in the Senate gallery or the Congressional gallery and, you know, the House of Representatives. And actually, during the House vote back in 2019, the congressman who represents my district, Lee Zeldin, actually came up in the galley and sat next to me. And that was pretty awesome. And anyway, good. I appreciate you I appreciate you doing this interview. You know, I'm sure John Field may have told you, you know, he'll get inundated with requests around 9/11. And it's good to talk to you in April. And, you know, any educators out there want a 9/11 responder, because when we go speak and give like a little history lesson, and now with the whiteboards, the Eno boards, I always start our little lesson or our little discussion with John Stewart's testimony.
Yeah.
And so now when the students actually see that, you see their faces, pretty impressive.
It's worth remembering that, you know, there are people graduating high school that weren't alive in 2001. I mean, to them, it is a historical, it's a historical event to all of us, but it feels especially historical. It feels like the way World War II would feel to me, you know.
Yeah, just yeah.
And belongs to my prehistory.
Yeah, and I'm sure, I don't know how young you were, I'm sure you probably have a good idea where you were that day.
I was in sixth grade at my parents' apartment when we saw the plane going. Yeah, so I was just young. I was old enough to have clear memory of it, but of course, young enough to not quite be able to process it. Sure. Not like anyone was, people forget the mire that we were all in, the miasma in the weeks following that horrible day.
I know one of the schools we were at recently, I'm walking down the hall with another respondent, said, you know what, I would have liked when I was going through high school to have like a, you know, back in the 80s, like a Pearl Harbor veteran come speak to us. That would have been pretty cool. And, yeah. You know, so anyway, that's kind of like, we do, you know, it's kind of subsided, but that's what the Feel Good Foundation does now. And then we constantly get calls where guys or gals are getting jerked around by the system with their benefits or whatnot. And we have to help them out with that also. So,
right. Understood. And just for our listeners, that's Feel Good Foundation, FEAL. Good Foundation. Yeah, I've made that mistake.
John's last name. Yep.
Yeah, that's right. John Feel. Perfect, man. Well, like I said, I appreciate you so much for the time. I hope I can interview every single one of you guys on a long enough timeline and hear your stories. But it was an honor to speak with you, and I hope you have a great rest of the day, sir.
All right. Take care, Josh.
All right. Thank you.
Right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on eyewitness history, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.